Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call the Academic Research and Student Affairs Committee to order. Could we please get a roll call?
Chair Geddes.
Here.
Vice Chair Del Carlo. Here. Regent Arascada. Regent Dubrava.
Here.
Regent Perkins.
Here.
Sorry, Regent Dubrava.
Here. Can you hear me?
Yes, now I can. Thank you. You have a quorum present.
Thank you. And I just want to make sure everybody knows that if you're not speaking and you're remote, if you could mute your microphones, it would be helpful to all of us. And when presenters, if you're up at the podium and you're presenting, you are allowed to remove your mask during the presentation. And then put them back on once you're done with your presentation. With that, we will go to item number one, public comment. Is there any public comment in ELCO?
No public comment from ELCO.
And there is no public comment in Reno. Is there any public comment in Las Vegas?
There is no public comment in Las Vegas.
Is there any written submitted public comment?
No written or submitted or public comment. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll go to item number two, consent agenda. Do I have a motion for approval of the consent agenda? Second. Motion from Regent Del Carlo. Do I have a second?
Second. Dubrava.
Second from Regent Perkins. Any questions or comments on the consent agenda? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. We will go to item number three, UNLV Organizational Unit Proposal, Patent and Trademark Resource Center. President Whitfield. Sorry, Provost Heavey.
Thank you, Chair Geddes, Vice Chair Del Carlo, and members of the Board of Regents. We're delighted to be before you today asking for approval for a Patent Trademark Resource Center at UNLV. The Patent Trademark Resource Center is a resource that will support innovation both on the campus and in the community. I want to thank the Dean of Libraries and our Economic Development team for leading this effort along with our law school library staff. And we've been working over the past several years, actually, with the U.S. Patent Trademark Center to get this center approved. And this is the final step in this process to bring this community and university resource online. We've also partnered with Switch in our local community, who will commit to funding additional resources to support the outreach of the center for a five-year commitment. And so we're very grateful for their partnership on this project as well. And like our sister institution in the north, which also has a patent trademark resource center, this will be a wonderful resource for the campus and the whole Las Vegas and Southern Nevada community. Happy to answer any questions if there are any.
Thank you. Do I have a motion for approval?
Mr. Chair, Regent Perkins, I just have a quick question. How does this integrate with the innovations, the Harry Reid Center?
The Harry Reid Center.
The technology black.
The Blackfire,
yeah.
The Research Park. So yes. One of the key partners in this is our economic development team, which is centered at the Blackfire Innovation Center at the Harry Reid Research and Technology Park. And so we will definitely be working with them and people who are partnering with them on any new innovations that might benefit from trademark or patent resources will be able to access this center. The center will actually be housed at the UNLV libraries primarily, but we'll definitely have outreach. We'll also have a community center in the Switch Innovation Center that they've committed to share space with us where we can also have outreach activities. So we think it'll be a great partnership for all of those involved.
And thank you for that. And, Mr. Chair, if I may, I'll make that motion for approval.
I have a motion for Regent Perkins. Do I have a second?
Second.
And that was?
Regent Ariscotta.
Regent Ariscotta for the second. Any other questions or comments? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Item number four, UNR program proposal, BS in kinesiology. President Sandoval.
Good morning, Chair Geddes, members of the committee. For the record, this is Brian Sandoval, president of the University of Nevada, Reno. With your permission, I'd like to ask Provost Jeff Thompson to present this agenda item.
Thank you. Provost Thompson.
Thank you. The first in our School of Community Health Sciences, which thanks to our Dean Trudy Larson, who recently retired from the university, we're able to get accreditation to be a School of Public Health, national accreditation. We're very proud of that effort. And as part of that, we have a degree program, which is a bachelor's degree in Community Health Sciences with an emphasis in kinesiology. Which we are seeking approval to change to a Bachelor's of Science degree in kinesiology. There's no change in the degree requirements or in the program of study, so it is a name change. It puts us in line with national programs for students graduating from the program having a degree in kinesiology will benefit them. And it also puts us in alignment with our sister program at UNLV and their School of Public Health with a bachelor's degree in kinesiology.
Thank you. Do I have a motion for approval?
Motion. Regent Del Carlo for approval.
Second.
Motion from Regent Del Carlo. Second from Regent Perkins. Any questions or comments? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. Item four, UNR program proposal, BS in Public Health. Provost Thompson.
Thank you, Regent Geddes. Again, Jeff Thompson for the record, Executive Vice President and Provost, University of Nevada, Reno. Also tied with our accreditation change for our School of Community Health Sciences into a School of Public Health. We have a Bachelor of Science that is in Community Health Sciences with an emphasis in Public Health. We're seeking approval to change the name to a Bachelor's of Science in Public Health. Again, to bring us into national norms for these degree programs, to support our students with a named degree program and their specialization. There's no change in the requirements for the degree or the plans of study, and will also bring us in alignment with the School of Public Health, with UNLV, with a bachelor's degree in public health.
Do I have a motion for approval from Regent Dubrava? Do I have a second?
Second, Regent Del Carlo.
Second from Regent Del Carlo. Any questions or comments? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously.
Thank you.
Now we will go to item number six, the NSC program proposal for a BS in chemistry. President Pillar.
Good morning, Chair Geddes, and good morning to the remainder of the committee. It's good to be here today. It's with pleasure I would ask our Provost, Dr. Vicki Shields, to make the presentation on this particular proposal.
Provost Shields, continue.
For the record, Vicki Shields, Provost and Executive Vice President at Nevada State College. Today I'm seeking board approval for a new Bachelor's of Science in Chemistry. This is a versatile program that prepares students for career success in an array of fields and delivers a strong foundation in different facets of chemistry with a particular focus on medical biological aspects of chemistry. The program will provide students with the opportunity to choose one of the following two concentrations, a biochemistry concentration or a professional chemistry concentration. The biochemistry concentration will primarily serve pre-medical professional students such as MD, DO, PA, PharmD, pre-dental, pre-veterinarian, as well as students preparing for careers in biochemical and biomedical professional fields. The professional chemistry concentration will serve students who are pursuing careers in professional chemistry and will have an emphasis on preparing students for graduate school. Students also can choose not to have a specific concentration, an option that is designed to serve students who wish to have relatively flexible degree requirements. This pathway, leading to a general chemistry degree, is ideal for those pursuing careers that require a general understanding of chemical concepts. Example careers may include patent law, chemical or pharmaceutical sales positions, or specialized chemistry programs such as atmospheric chemistry. True to our mission, Nevada State serves a student population that is diverse in every sense of the word, including 50% first-gen, 49% low-income students. Approximately 70% of our student population are from historically underserved populations, and our students are predominantly female, with women making up 79% of our overall student body. We are well poised to produce graduates who are predominantly female and are from diverse racial and ethnic backgrounds, groups often deficient in the STEM fields. Nevada State College currently offers two other BS degrees in biology and environmental science in the natural science disciplines. There is a need to create additional physical science programs to provide a wider range of training to better match the diverse interests of NSC students within physical science disciplines and better serve the workforce of Nevada. Chemistry at Nevada State contains a nearly complete core set of faculty to support the degree program, requires the addition of only 16 courses to offer the BS degree, can support additional programs in the future, such as forensics, physics, and chemical engineering, offers well-rounded training within the sciences. Students engaging in chemistry also must be exposed to aspects of biology, biochemistry, math, and physics. There is a demand in Nevada for well-trained chemists, both in the industry and to feed into graduate and medical programs at the university level. We anticipate headcount of 10 in year one, 25 in year two, and 30 in year three, and these might be conservative estimates. I would be happy to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Provost Shields. Do I have a motion for approval?
Move to approve. Regent Arescada, motion.
Regent Perkins, second.
Regent Arescada, motion approval. Regent Perkins seconded it. And I will tell you, as a someone who got my biochemistry degree, I love this program. But our paths diverge, and I hope none of your graduates ever decide to want to be a regent. But we will digress.
Thank you.
All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. We'll go to item number 7, CSN Program Proposal A in Computer Science. President Zaragoza.
Mr. Chairman, Regents, here to present this item is Mr. James McCoy, Vice President of Academic Affairs.
Good morning, Chair Geddes and ARSA committee members. My name is James McCoy, Chief Academic Officer for CSN for the record, and I'm pleased to present today the Associate of Arts degree in Computer Science for your consideration. Currently, CSN, as you well know, has an Associate of Applied Science in Computer Science right now, and it's doing quite well. But also, as you know, the AAS degrees, or the Associate of Applied Science degrees, are indeed intended for direct-to-workforce, not intended for direct-to-transfer to one of our four-year sister institutions. And so, this proposed associate degree in computer science is a transferable program for students who are planning to transfer to a baccalaureate-level institution to further their study in computer science. The employability data indicates the need for the proposed degree to improve employability prospects of students and to meet the needs of the industry to provide an educated workforce from a stackable credential standpoint. Again, the associate degree transferring into a baccalaureate program at UNLV or UNR. To meet the industry needs and to improve these employability opportunities for students, the program provides the knowledge and the skills that lead to further specialized study of computer science at the four-year college or university through offering a core set of computer-related courses in addition to the general study courses that would be applicable for transfer. We worked with UNLV to create a formal 2+2 transfer and articulation agreement complete with a term-by-term academic course map sequence for all 4 years. Further, we received a letter of support from UNR indicating that students may easily transfer to UNR with this AA from CSN in computer science. I have with me two colleagues from CSN, Dr. Michael Spangler, Dean of our School of Advanced and Applied Tech, and Professor Nasser Hervabi, Chair for the Department of Computer and Information Technologies, and we are all here and happy to answer any questions you may have. Thank you for the consideration today.
Thank you. Do I have a motion for approval?
Move to approve.
Motion to approve, Regent Del Carlo.
Motion from Regent Del Carlo, a second. Second from Regent Arascata.
Yes.
Any questions or comments? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously.
Thank you.
Congratulations. We will now go to item number 8, TMCC Program Proposals, Associate of Arts, President Hilgerson.
Good morning, Chair Geddes and members of the ARSA committee. It's a pleasure to be with you today. For the record, my name is Jeffrey Alexander, and I'm the Vice President of Academic Affairs at Truckee Meadows Community College, today representing President Hilgerson. For your consideration today, we would like to present four degrees, Associate of Arts degrees that TMCC is proposing. They are essentially in operation presently, but we discovered that following an audit, they were not listed in the NSHE Academic Program Information System, or APIS. The college is seeking to have these emphases converted to primary fields of study, standalone Associate of Arts degrees, so that they can be listed on students' transcripts in lieu of the general AA. Each of these proposed degrees have seamless transfer agreements with UNR, and we have full-time faculty in place to teach the program courses, many of which are offered as service learning courses to a wide array of programs across the college. Cost estimates mainly reflect salaries of existing staff, faculty and support staff, et cetera. I'll go through each of them in turn. The first is the Associate of Arts in Business. This is one of our most popular program areas with between 100 and 125 students per year identifying themselves as business majors in each of the last 5 years. Headcount and FTE projections are based on a five-year average. There's about a 2% increase in majors each year, especially as we recover from enrollment loss due to the pandemic. The second is the Associate of Arts in Entrepreneurship. This is a smaller program. There's about 20 graduates among the Associate of Arts students who declare that emphasis. Headcount has increased to 21 students in fall 2019. There's a noticeable increase in Hispanic students as well, from 20 to over 26%. And the courses do indeed service a great many Associate of Arts and Associate of Applied Science programs. Third is the Associate of Arts in Political Science, a longstanding emphasis that has around a dozen majors at present. And there are many students who have declared this in recent years, including students pursuing the AA political science emphasis, as well as students seeking to transfer to UNR and other fields who take these courses in political science as well. UNR faculty took great interest in reviewing the proposed program, which has resulted in follow-up dialogue with our political science chair. And finally, the Associate of Arts in Social Work. This is a very robust program with enrollment growth in social work courses from 86 to 219 students between fall 2018 and 2020. This program also attracts a large percentage of Hispanic students who have exhibited higher percentages of completion and successful completion rates in social work and counseling and personal development courses that are part of the degree compared to the college as a whole. Headcount and FTE are based on a five-year average, again with about 2% increase in majors per year. The social work courses are currently taught by part-time instructors. Thank you.
Thank you. I have a motion for approval from Regent Dubrava. Do I have a second?
Second, Arascata.
Second from Regent Arascata. Any questions or comments?
Chair Geddes, I do. Arascata.
Yes,
just on
Regent
a side Arascata. Note, just looking at the impact of benefit almost 500 students from the numbers I was reading on all the provided paperwork. Huge. Also, the swift transfer of credits to the four-year colleges. After speaking with a couple of the deans at both those institutes, they welcome this with open arms. Well done.
Thank you, Regent Arascata.
Seeing no other questions or comments, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
We will now go to item number 9, 2019-2020. Nishi Financial Aid Report, Associate Vice Chancellor Davis.
Good morning. I'm happy to be here to give this annual report on NCHI financial aid across the system. For the record, Renee Davis, Associate Vice Chancellor of Academic and Student Affairs. And I can work the remote, so that's a good sign. This is a slide that we typically start with because we always want to make the point that financial aid is not only crucial to our students, but it's also the cornerstone upon which three of the five board strategic goals are built on: access, success, and closing the achievement gap. And we have other reasons that we report annually on financial aid. Part of that is a requirement, certain requirements in board policy. As you all know, it's a constantly changing national climate, so we like to keep you up to date on that. And we just really think the conversation is important to have periodically. Typically, I start with this slide every year. This shows the growth of all financial aid programs combined. And you can see that in 2019-20, $652 million in financial aid, and that's comprehensive of all scholarship loans, grants that students get across all of the institutions. And you can see there that that's a 2.1% increase over the last year. And then over that five-year period we use in the financial aid report, about a 10.9% increase. This slide shows the total disbursed by institution. So this breaks it down by institution. And you can see here that there were mostly increases across the board, certainly over the last year, 18-19 to 19-20. And then you see that there was a little bit of a mixed bag over the five-year period. You'll notice there that GBC had the biggest increase. A lot of that is tied to increased enrollment over that period. And then that decrease you see at Western Nevada is primarily due to a few factors. Talked with their financial aid director, and one is their shifting enrollment to dual enrollment students. Those students don't typically qualify for financial aid, and they don't qualify for sure for federal aid. And also, they've had a very long period of working with students to minimize borrowing. So those combined factors resulted in that decrease. This is another breakdown by institution and race, ethnicity. And what we added this year to the slide is the two rows at the bottom, which compares the institution percentage of non-white students with the recipient percentage. So you can see that those figures are right in line with what you should see. They're a little bit higher in all cases than the population percentage. Pell Grant is the biggest single program that assists our neediest students. And so we always like to have a slide to talk a little bit about the Pell Grant. Now, in 1920, the maximum award was actually $6,195. Not all students get that maximum award, and part of that has to do with their need, and the other part has to do with their enrollment level. So when you look at the averages, you can kind of see that progression over the 5 years on this slide. In 1920, the average was $3,824, and that compares to a national average of $4,170. Loans, again, always a topic of concern. We don't want to see our students taking on more debt than they can pay back after graduation, or you know, even worse if they don't graduate and they still leave with some debt. So all of our campuses have pretty rigorous debt management and financial literacy programs. They all have a slightly different flavor, but there are major efforts on our campuses to educate students about student debt and borrowing wisely if that becomes necessary. You can see that the numbers are pretty flat for the last five-year period. And if you actually look at these in steady dollars, then there's actually a decrease. So it's pretty good news for us. And then there's some notes there on the slide regarding the national climate, which there are decreases nationally as well. Now, in Nevada, we have these kind of six programs that we report to the National Association on State Student Grant and Aid Programs, funded with state dollars. So we have, of course, the Governor Gwynne Millennium Scholarship that is a large program and has been growing substantially in the last several years. It's up to, in 1920, it was almost a $40 million to students at NSHE institutions. We also have the Nevada Grant and Aid, which is that is more of a catch-all category. Talked about that a couple years ago in more detail. That could be things like the athletic grant and aid, graduate student grant and aid. And by the way, that has real money behind those dollars as opposed to something like a fee waiver, which we're going to be presenting on in a little while. So another program, Nevada Promise Scholarship, as you know, that's a newer one established in 2018. Fairly small, and it's offered at the community colleges. There's the Regents Higher Education Opportunity Award, and that program is funded both by dollars from the state-supported operating budget and the set-aside from tuition. In fact, it's over 80% of the funds, 84.4, you'll see in that note at the bottom of the slide, come from the set-aside from registration fees. We also have the Regent Service Program, which is something the board established. It's a work program. And then, of course, the Silver State Opportunity Grant, which is our only state-funded, need-based program for students at the NSHE institutions. And that program...
Renee?
Yes.
Sorry. Just for the new members on the board who haven't seen this report, could you expand more on the Higher Education Opportunity Award and the how those access dollars come out of student fees? And I know we'll see that in a different report later, but if you could just expand on that, I would appreciate it.
Absolutely. So there's a policy, and we talk about this a little bit in the report, that the board put in place. I'm sorry, I can't remember off the top of my head the year that the policy came into place, but essentially by 2022-23, each institution is required to set aside a certain percentage of the registration fee for the universities and the upper division at the community colleges and NSC, it's 15%, and then the community colleges, it's 10%. And so when you look at, when you approve the fee increases, there also comes along with that the distribution of fees that's in the procedures and guidelines manual, and you'll see that there's a line for student access, and that's actually the financial aid dollars that are used to fund students with the access funds. In addition, each of the institutions do have some monies that come out of the state supported operating budget, so it's mixed there in those numbers. But again, that note at the bottom does explain that 84% comes from the registration fee set aside. So a very small amount now comes from the state-supported operating budget. Regent Geddes, does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you very much.
You're welcome. And there's a lot more information. We've come out with a couple reports on the Silver State Opportunity Grant. We do one every other year. So your five report just came out in January of this year. And then we also published a Nevada Promise report. That report came out in July. So those are both available on the website. There are links here from the slides. But if you need to get access to them, just feel free to contact me and I can send them along. Now I wanted to shift a little bit, show you some more data from the financial aid report, but also give you a little background on financial aid. And so apologies to those of you who've heard this information before, but I think it's important to continue as we have new regents coming onto the board. I think it's really important for them to get this information. So some financial aid basics. When we do our reporting every year in the financial aid report, we talk about category, source, type, and cost of attendance. I'm going to give you some details on the next slides on how we describe each of those categories. And I want to talk a little bit about the free application for federal student aid, otherwise known as the FAFSA, because that really is where everything starts for students in terms of any need-based aid pretty much in our state. So this may be a little basic, but grants are generally need-based, not always. Those awards are not paid back. Loans, of course, are paid back. But there are need-based and non-need-based loans. And so a need-based loan generally would be from the federal government, and that would be where the government covers any interest while the student's enrolled in higher education. Work-study is what it sounds like. It's provides positions for students, hopefully in something that connects them with work that is meaningful towards their career goals, but it may not be. I mean, they may work in the financial aid office or the registrar's office. But they earn wages, but it's still part of the financial aid package, and it has it's treated differently by the next year's financial aid application. And then scholarships are merit-based awards. Sometimes they have a need component, sometimes they don't. Our biggest program, as you all know, is the Governor Gwynne Millennium Scholarship. So this is how things broke down in 2019-20. 42.1% of all aid awarded, so of that $652 million, is loans. And that's a mixture of need-based and non-need-based loans. But the good news is that proportion is actually going down. So you'll see in the slide there that in 15-16 it was 46.8%, and for many years it was hovering around that 46% range. So it's good to see that some of the other programs are growing in relationship to the loans. So when it comes to sources of financial aid, of course the federal government is the biggest source. The state, the institution, and the biggest source of the institutional aid is the Regents Higher Education Opportunity Award, as I just mentioned. But there are also scholarships, grants, and other things that are funded often from endowments and those types of things. And we consider those institutional because they are awarded to the institution, and then the institution takes over the awarding. And then you have the private category, which is more like there's an external agency. They send a check to the school for the student for a scholarship. And so here's the breakdown. In 1920, 62.9% was federal aid. And our federal aid percentage tends to be high. I mean, that's not different from nationwide. 71% in 14-15. So that also is changing a little as some of our internal aid programs grow and the dynamics of the federal aid programs change here and there. What we call type is basically the need versus the non-need. So for the need, need needs to be determined, and usually that's determined by using the FAFSA, but there needs to be some sort of tool, and there's going to be a methodology for awarding need-based aid. Non-need-based aid, there may or may not be a review of need before a student is awarded non-need aid. Could be done with or without a student filing the FAFSA, so there's a little more leeway there. However, you can see that the categories are the same. It's just that it's more common for a grant to be need-based, whereas it's more common for a scholarship to be non-need-based. But those things change. And so what we like to do is keep an eye on this, and in my opinion, probably of most financial aid administrators out there, it's not really a great trend. So what we're seeing is that the percentage overall of that big number that I reported, the need-based portion is actually shrinking in comparison to the the non-need-based. Now, why is that? It's fairly complex, and probably two of the biggest factors is the growth of the Millennium Scholarship Program, because that is such a huge part of the overall aid. And that, of course, as I've told you, is not a need-based program. We also have the Nevada Promise Scholarship. While not really big in dollars, so doesn't have a large impact, it does kind of just stay on that trend of non-need-based aid. And then, you know, the Pell fluctuates based on federal methodology, based on the student population, based on the economy, so that could also be a factor there. So I think really the message here is that we need to be looking at ways to increase need-based aid in our state, and hopefully that is going to be part of the discussion at the legislative study, but that remains to be seen. Another really important concept in determining financial aid awards is cost of attendance. And the reason I talk about cost of attendance is because we all know this, but sometimes we forget that the cost to a student is much more than just what it's going to cost to buy, to pay the registration fees and buy books. Obviously, there's the, you know, all of this list here, the housing, the room and board, transportation, personal expenses. But there's also that opportunity cost of I'm in school, so I'm not working or earning money. So it's something that it's really important to keep in mind, that in the ideal world, we would cover the student's full cost of attendance so they could come to school and not have to worry about those other pressures in life. Of course, that's not realistic right now. So we do the best we can with the resources that we have. And so I'm not going to spend any time on this, but I knew that whenever I talk about cost of attendance, then folks want to know what is the cost of attendance at our institution. So I have three slides here. There are ones off campus, ones on campus, and one is with parents. So the off campus, living without your parents is a different cost than living with parent. And the way campuses determine which category a student fits in is based on how the student answers that question on the FAFSA. Now, the free application for federal student aid, I've referenced in a number of places, and I just wanted to remind you that if you wanted to dig in a little deeper, there are some FAFSA changes coming in 2022-23, and I did a presentation in June on that topic, so there's a link there to that presentation. And I've already mentioned that the FAFSA is the way that we determine need. I won't go into too much detail here, but there's some basic information on the slide. It really has to do with taking the cost of attendance and subtracting the estimated family contribution. And here are a couple examples of a lower need and a higher need student. One's a university student, one's a community college student, and what a sample award might look like. Now, don't be alarmed with all the abbreviations. That's just so I could put it on the slide. What the student actually gets in an offer letter is much more explanatory. So they do get a lot more information when they do get their financial aid offer.
And Renee, sorry.
Yes.
In regards to the FAFSA, there was that legislation that was passed in session to assist students with the FAFSA. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. So that bill basically set up a requirement that, frankly, I think was already happening at the majority of high schools across the state. But basically, the student, the school, the K-12 institution is supposed to communicate with the student by the end of September to let them know what opportunities for getting FAFSA information will be. And then there's a deadline for offering like a financial aid night or some sort of training or informational session on the FAFSA. And so that bill just reinforces those efforts that all of our campuses were engaging in. They have great partnerships with their communities, and I mean, that's something that they do every year is go out and do tons of financial aid nights, help students fill out applications. Lots of times there are FAFSA workshops, so that just reinforces the work that our institutions have been doing.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And then I just wanted to end up with some information on HERF. HERF 1, we put the figures here because it fits within roughly within the time period we're reporting on. I wanted to make the point that we did not blend these figures into the normal financial aid data because I didn't want to have a blip where, you know, in 4 years, 5 years, I come and we're like, oh, my God, what happened? We got this huge reduction. Well, so we're going to just keep this separate, still report on it to keep it separate. And by the way, each of the institutions per the federal guidelines have a web page that reports on their HERF expenditures. So if you ever want to go and take a look at those numbers and what's happening, they have great pages there on their websites. And so that concludes my presentation. Are there any questions?
Regent Geddes, Regent Arascata.
Yes, Regent Arascata. Go ahead.
Foremost, thank you very much. I'm one of the newer ones, and your description and explanation of everything was very well done. I really appreciate it. On table 15, it's the NSHE financial aid recipients by race and ethnicity. One of the questions, and one of the most underrepresented students on campus, on all campuses, are students with disabilities. Under Section 504 of the 1973 Rehabilitation Act, it excludes and makes sure that individuals with disabilities receive equal opportunity. Do you have any statistics or future statistics for students with disabilities be included on this?
So we don't currently collect that data with the system student data warehouse, which is where we pull this data from. But we definitely will explore the feasibility of doing that in the future. I think that's an excellent point, a population we should be looking at, just like we do race, ethnicity.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments?
Yes, this is Regent Del Carlo. I have a comment.
Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you very much. I just want to say thank you for this report. To me, this is the heart of what we do. And when you start on slide 3, the very first line, no student should be denied a college education due to an inability to pay for it. This is why we're here. And I think this is probably the most important thing we do, is making sure we have students that are able to come. And this is just great. And I talked to a young man here this morning who's just working, and I just made him a note. And I told him to come in on item number 9 on this agenda today, and I'm going to give him this note because, you know, FOSFA's free. I mean, the first word in that is free. So nobody should be not denied, and thank you for this update. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Regent Del Carlo. Any other questions or comments?
Chair Geddes, this is Regent Carvalho. I had a question.
Yes, Regent Carvalho.
On page number 7, where it states NSHE average annual Pell Grant disbursements by student, is that, and we see that for 1920, that's $4,170. Is that the average of all students receiving the Pell Grant?
Correct. For the annual period as well.
Thank you. So, I'm glad that you mentioned during your presentation that there's some opportunity there, because 4170 versus the 6195 of the maximum Pell Grant, there's a big difference there, and I'd be curious to know. I'm sure it's not just one area that that there's opportunities with, but there's some money being left on the table by our students, and I'd like to do everything that we can to help them get that maximum Pell Grant if possible.
Yes, if I may respond to that, Renee Davis. Part of it, there could be money left on the table for students who choose to attend less than full time, so they could get more funding. The other part of that is based on their EFC or their eligibility. So a student who's going full-time but who doesn't have the maximum need based on the FAFSA, they actually may top out at a lower number. But there definitely are students who go part-time who could get a larger Pell Grant award.
Thank you for that. Thank you, Chair Geddes.
Thank you, Regent Carvalho. Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much, Renee. As Regent Del Carlo said, this is one of my favorite reports, so I appreciate it. We will now go to item number 10, co-requisite implementation. Vice Chancellor Abba.
Thank you. For the record, Crystal Abba, Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs. Regent Geddes asked that I introduce this item, partly because it's such a point of pride. This committee will recall that it was in June of 19 that the board adopted a mandate for full-scale co-requisite implementation by this fall. And the good news is we have met your request and we are at full-scale implementation, which was no undaunting feat in the course of 2 years in a global pandemic. And I know those applause are not for me. They're intended for the institutions, because while I was involved at the very top of this, this type of work will never, ever succeed unless the faculty buy in. And I asked Brandon Protis from Complete College America, who has been our undaunting partner in all of this, to come and speak and give his perspective, as well as two faculty members who happen to be women who I consider to be absolute champions of co-requisite work, because these are the individuals that were on the ground doing this work, and it's their perspective that I think is so utterly valuable, so that you can hear that this has become absolutely embraced by our faculty, and it is literally about changing the culture of our institutions, whereby we are no longer doing traditional remediation, but we are providing students the support that they need when they need it for math and English. And so with that, it is with great pride that I turn it over to Brandon from Complete College America. Thank you for being here, Brandon.
Thank you. Chairman Geddes and committee members, on behalf of Complete College America and our president, Dr. Yolanda Watson-Spiva, I would like to thank the Nevada System of Higher Education Board of Regents for this opportunity to be able to speak to you about the implementation of co-requisite support in the state of Nevada. I am Dr. Brandon Protis. I am a strategy director at Complete College America, and I've been working with NCHE over the past year and a half on this initiative. I will tell you that I am incredibly impressed by the approach from the leadership of the state, from the colleges, and from the universities, from the faculty, to make this initiative both a success and for it to be sustained over the long term. I would like to acknowledge Crystal Abba, the Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs, Renee Davis, the Associate Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs, and James McCoy, the Vice President of Academic Affairs at the College of Southern Nevada, as well as members of the COREC faculty math and English task forces, including Laura Decker and Ann Flesher, who you will hear from today after I speak. So since its founding in 2009, Complete College America has been recognized at the state and national levels as a fierce advocate to increase college completion rates and to decrease and eliminate achievement gaps. We have a framework that's based off promoting policy to scale change and implement evidence-based strategies across the country, and co-requisite support is definitely one of these strategies. So Nevada joined Complete College America Alliance in 2010 and has worked with us very closely so we can support your statewide reform efforts. At a previous meeting to this Board of Regents, and she presented No Room for Doubt, Moving Co-Requisite Support from Idea to Imperative, which is our latest signature publication focused on co-requisite support. And this work was based off of work we've done in more than a dozen states to bring co-requisites to scale. And I will tell you, without reservation, Nevada is doing great work and is an exemplar for other states to follow. There we go. Just to ensure that we are all on the same page, I just want to give a quick review of what co-requisite support is. So in the traditional prerequisite model, which you'll see on the left, students take up to multiple classes of prerequisite remediation before they're even given access to the college-level English or math course. Usually those classes do not count towards their degree or for college credit. Now, the model you'll see on the right is the co-requisite support model, and that students go directly into a college-level English or math course from their very first term, and they may be either required or can opt into that additional support, and they do that in the same semester. This is good for students because they spend less time and less of their tuition dollars and have a significantly higher pass rate into those college-level English and math courses. Now, this is also a benefit for institutions because colleges and universities, as they see those increase in pass rates in the college-level English and math courses, this yields to higher retention rates and then higher progress towards graduation, which is the ultimate goal. Co-requisite support is a structural solution because it eliminates the many attrition points in between those multiple semesters when students, either if they don't pass, or many who do pass but don't continue from semester to semester. And this has a disproportionate impact on our students of color. It is also a pedagogical approach. It's a change in how we teach, focusing on just-in-time teaching support, focusing on what is needed for that college-level class. There's particular focus put on the affective domain and growth mindset of students and culturally relevant teaching practices that works on student strengths. So Complete College America has advocated for co-requisite support at scale for the past decade. When we first started talking about it, it was a brand new concept, and it created a lot of fear. One, because it was new. And so one of the things that we talk about is having a grassroots and a grass-tops approach, and this is exactly what we've seen in Nevada. So the grass-tops approach is policy. It sets a clear vision of what that reform is and a standard of practice for all students. Now, this has to be combined with the grassroots approach because we know change is a process, and you can have the best policy, but if it's not implemented, it doesn't mean anything. And it takes a little bit for individuals and institutions to shift their paradigms because it's people who are at the center of this, and it has to be handled with care and respect. So the Complete College America framework for systems transformation is focused on shifting policy, creating the conditions for change, and implementing strategies. And I'm going to move my comments based off of this framework. So in terms of shifting policy, the urgency of the reform, as Vice Chancellor Abba mentioned, came from in 2019. Actually, Complete College America came to this board and provided testimony. That was followed by a white paper that NSHE put out, which showed the data from the state. It mirrored what we saw nationally, but it showed state specific data that highlighted the challenges with Nevada in Nevada with the remediation at that time. The policy that moved forward set a goal of moving all students who had previously had to go into developmental education through a typical remediation model, that they would all move to a co-rec model starting this fall of 2021. This is huge. Changing the entire system of developmental education cannot be understated. Now, the Board of Regents and NSHE also identified funding to support this implementation. And while all of this might seem very obvious because it is a textbook example of how this should happen, I can tell you this is not what happens in many states. So we've seen states that have not achieved the same results for multiple reasons, such as not setting a mandate or a target for the number or percentage of students or colleges that would go into a co-requisite model. Or we've seen a state who said that they would go to scale, but never defined what that meant to go to scale. Policies that allowed for co-requisite along with other reform models that are less effective, so it's sort of a choice among many. And we've also seen policies that are implicit rather than explicit and allow loopholes so that colleges are still offering many sections of traditional prerequisite remediation. And so what you see here is the timeline that was done in Nevada and includes policy, includes setting up task forces, and creating implementation action plans. And when we zoom in, we see that NSHE's deliberate and intentional process of including policy, curricular reform, implementation, and continuous improvement are all part of this. And this is important as we move faculty, staff, and administrators to this foundational shift fundamentally of how we see and serve our students. This is important because for there to be longevity and sustainability for initiative, you need to have this long-range view because otherwise it's very easy for it to be seen as a one-and-done, a flash in the pan, a flavor of the week, and cynically sometimes something that can be ignored because this too shall pass rather than this is a full commitment. So as we move to the creating conditions for change, we know that you cannot over-communicate throughout this process. And there have to be multiple audiences, both internally, our faculty, our staff, our administrators, of what it means philosophically and why colleges and universities are moving to this model, as well as externally to our students, to our parents, our high school counselors, of what this means. And we see an example of this in the bottom right of the screen. This was a social media post and postcard that NSHAD put together, where it says very clearly, every college student is college ready. That's a very clear message. Now, Complete College America has been inspired by this, and actually we're going to be releasing a co-requisite media toolkit somewhat based off of what we've seen in the state of Nevada. The reason why it's important to communicate well is we need to ensure that individuals and colleges understand the structural shortcomings of the long sequences of prerequisite remediation, and that we value and we do not blame our faculty or our students, which can easily happen. It's the structure that's not the problem. It's our faculty that are the answers. And we do this by using data to show the overall impacts as well as the disparate impacts on racially minoritized groups, and that was done here in Nevada. And the data also needs to show beyond just what the issue is, it needs to drive action, and that's what was done here in building a new model and for continuous improvement. And so Complete College America will continue to partner in Nevada as we work on student learning outcomes to be able to share and improve best practices across the state. Now, Nevada engaged faculty and advisors very deeply, in depth, over time with this. So I'd like to quote, I mentioned that we did our work in more than a dozen states, and we had a third-party neutral evaluator. And one of the statements that our evaluator made was, be mindful of how you manage the change process, and importantly, to the extent possible, go beyond seeking faculty buy-in, and instead make co-rec implementation a faculty-driven enterprise. So moving from buy-in to somebody else's vision to something that is owned by the faculty. And this is what was done by setting up these faculty task force, both on the math and the English side, and you'll see that there's representatives from the 7 public colleges and universities in the state. They were tasked over time, they met on a regular basis to develop co-requisite implementation action plans and to identify what the faculty professional development needs were to prepare faculty for this giant move. This is an example, again, of that grass tops and a grassroots approach, putting faculty at the center to drive this. So NSHE allowed multiple opportunities for faculty to hear about, discover, wrestle with, and ultimately be part of the solution of co-requisite support. And I'll be honest, even myself, when I was on a campus, you hear it once and you sort of get it because it makes common sense. But on the other hand, it challenges what we've always been doing, so it doesn't make sense. And sometimes you need to hear the message multiple times and to be able to fight with it and ultimately accept it. And so what I've seen over the time as I met monthly with the task forces is I've seen that transformation of the faculty going from maybe a point of not sure what this was or ambivalence or maybe even some pushback to truly embracing the co-requisite model. Now, naturally, there's a tendency for skepticism, maybe even cynicism, and the key to this is deep engagement with the faculty. What NSHE did is they provided the guidance and the support, but then empowered the faculty to lead the efforts. And what I saw is that transformation from support from NSHE, then moving from support from faculty to faculty as they became champions. So co-requisite is a structural solution, but it also requires changes in classroom instruction. And so this is combined with a multiple measures approach and math pathways, which is done in Nevada so that the math 120, 124, and 126 all are combined with a co-requisite model. What a common myth is or a misunderstanding is that you're just taking all of that prerequisite coursework and just shoving it together, but it's not compression. It's focusing on a just-in-time teaching that is based off the student's funds of knowledge and a metacognition of what it means to be a student. Now, this is combined with connecting initial coursework in these college-level English math and English courses, their first courses, with what their higher-end goals are, and this is really an important strategy for combating stereotype threat that particularly impacts our Black, Latinx, and Indigenous students. There's also the focus on the effective domain and growth mindset, and this is done through engaged classroom activities that build social connection across and among the students. It taps into the cultural wealth that the students bring into the classroom with them. So I mentioned the faculty professional development. And what you see here on the screen is these are flyers that we did, and it was the math faculty and English task force that determined both the number and the topics for this professional development. We work across multiple states, and we've worked in other states that did a series of three total for math and English. But what you see here is there was 9 sessions for math and 10 in English. This is a huge number, and the faculty were allowed to drive that through these task force of what was needed. And the topics range from everything from co-rec support 101, placement, just-in-time instruction, active learning, growth mindset, online instruction, and more. And what I want to point out is you'll see that we brought in national content-level experts, so researchers, department chairs, deans from other colleges who have successfully implemented this to be able to talk about what works. But you'll also see that we provided a showcase for Nevada faculty to be able to talk about what they've been doing and pilot it in their own institutions as a way of showcasing the work that's happening internally. So I remember as an example, one time we had a math panel who were talking about their initial discomfort with co-requisite. They were taught math, right? They knew math. So pedagogy is a little bit different, and particularly when you start talking about some of the non-content pieces of the non-cognitive of how you coach a student, some of them, they talked about what they did wrong. Then they talked about what they did right, and what I heard from the multiple members on that panel was that this had the largest impact on their teaching of anything. And so that was an example of moving from fear to that full embrace. They challenged themselves to be able to be a little bit uncomfortable and see the value in this model. So clearly, this is developing champions, and this was because of the efforts and the leadership of Nevada. There was strong attendance at these sessions, and they were recorded so people can view them offline. And one of the unexpected things that came out was the faculty themselves asked for continued communities of practice. They said, we love this. Can we continue to meet as math faculty? Can we continue to meet as English faculty? So in closing, I would like to say that Nevada is at an exciting point, poised to see the great improvements because of the intentional approach to policy, creating the conditions for change, and the strategies. We hope to see those increases not only in the completion of the English and math courses, but college completion rates and the reduction and elimination of achievement gaps. This is again because of this grassroots and grass tops approach that sets a clear vision for that educational transformation, as well as the support for the faculty and the staff to be able to lead this effort. As I said, Nevada is an exemplar, and that's why we showcased them in our national publication, No Room for Doubt. We also highlighted them in our June newsletter that goes out to over 30,000 recipients across the country. So as Complete College America works to identify partners who have the vision and the commitment to move forward a college completion agenda, we are privileged to work with and see the progress from the Nevada System of Higher Education to scale co-requisite support for all students, and we look forward to our continued partnership. And with that, I'm going to invite Ann Flesher up.
Chair, this is General Counsel Joe Reynolds. I'd just like to give a friendly reminder for all speakers to continue wearing their face covering while speaking. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for that reminder. Good morning. I am Ann Flesher. I am the Dean of the Math and Physical Sciences Division at Truckee Meadows Community College, and I am very honored and excited to present to you the NC Pilot Year in Math, moving from long sequences in math to the just-in-time co-requisite support. Of course, I would like to begin by thanking Dr. Brandon Protos from Complete College America for his work and his support of Nevada's reform. Of course, I want to thank Crystal Abba, Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs, Renee Davis, Assistant Vice Chancellor and Director of Student Affairs, and also James McCoy, Vice President of Academic Affairs at CSN, but was first our sort of lead director in convening the NC Task Force. And he presented both action plans to the board last year. I would also be remiss not to thank all the people who have gotten us to this point, all the institutional task forces, the NC task forces, the faculty, and everyone who has played such significant roles in this rollout. So I echo Brandon in saying that Nevada is doing great work. It kind of began, this timeline is a snapshot of the timeline from the Complete College America report on No Room for Doubt on highlighting Nevada's timeline from idea to execution. But really, since the report in 2015 from a task force on gateway mathematics success, the problems became very apparent and the solutions were not. Nationally, the movement to co-requisite reform as a successful model was developing across the country. And even though back in March of 2019, I was faculty senate chair-elect, I voiced many concerns about eliminating standalone remedial math class. And yet I stand here today excited to share the efforts underway and many of the positive outcomes we've seen already. When the policy was then passed in June of 2019 and the timeline was established, I still, like many of my colleagues, feared what was going to happen. I feared everything was going to be decided for us, but that's not what happened. I really like this term, grassroots, grass top effort, for what Nevada has done. We all took ownership of the problem that had persisted for years, and we had to do our parts within our purviews to make the changes. A date that's missing on this timeline that I want to highlight is in November of 2019, which was sadly the last time the task force got together in person. But we came together, the math task force teams came together, and we really grappled with what co-requisite would look like, and we developed a new common course numbering system. Why would that be needed? Well, the old system and the old pathways had its flaws. It was nationally known that completion of a gateway math class is, of course, a strong indicator of student success and of graduation. But for those that may not know the history, there were efforts to try and address the problem. Accelerated courses, stretch models, compressed courses, skill centers. And the Common Core numbering system reflected this. It was a wash of numbers with letters that was making no sense to us and no sense, I'm sure, to the students on their transcripts. And the pipeline was still leaky. So this first major accomplishment was when the NC Math Task Force cleaned up the Common Course numbering system, made it simpler, and redefined our classes to be just-in-time co-requisite support classes and no longer prerequisite classes. So we developed our new pathways. We came together. One of the challenges that we face in Nevada is we do operate as a system, but we have to implement at scale. But we also have to allow institutions individual flexibility to do what's needed with their populations. But we did all this. We grappled and we considered staffing issues, scheduling issues, credentialing, subject differences, pathway differences, credit hours for support. We all understood that consistency across the system is to the benefit of our students. So while the policy change was initiated by the board, we found in the process that we got to rethink and redesign our courses. And institutions were given a lot of flexibility, and we appreciate that. Curriculum design, delivery modes, professional development, the support model structures, and our assessment. So although we shared a goal to develop the co-requisite model at scale that could be implemented across the system while maintaining institutional individuality, we faced many barriers. And I want to thank Crystal Ava, Vice Chancellor of Academic and Student Affairs, who heard this and when needed came in for support and assistance. At the time, we grappled with 124 and 126, and it was determined that a curriculum review committee was needed to really look at those classes. Are they distinct? Are they the same? And it was decided, based off historical data and based off of what they are needed for, that they could remain distinct, and that was really helpful for the institutions who already had these classes in motion. Another example, as Brandon highlighted, and sorry for the redundancy, was that professional development series. Yeah. A team of us got together, really looked at what would be needed in the system and at the institutions, and we brainstormed our ideas, and the system responded. But they responded in a way not just by bringing in outside content experts to say, here is how to do it in a different state, for example. They also provided a space, which is different from many other reforms that I have sort of gone through, is that they provided a space for the faculty to get together, cross-institutional conversations about what's needed, what's working, and what isn't working. And this type of support structure, I hope, continues as we are now in full implementation. So again, sorry for the redundancy, but this is the Math Professional Development Series. And it was a collaborative process, and with the help of Complete College America, we developed a very outstanding and well-attended professional development series that addressed all sorts of aspects from placement, content, delivery, assessment, design. And I really want to see this kind of approach continue. I think the camaraderie and the support strengthened us as educators on all levels. The collaboration across the institutions, I think, has been tremendous, and it creates a network for us to work within. And of course, I want to thank NSHE and the board, as we did receive funding, and aligning resources with needs is an important aspect to this reform. Institutions had opportunities and still have opportunities to address their own shortfalls in this, whether that be credentialing, staffing, classroom improvement, wraparound support, training, curriculum development, just to name a few. So we're very thankful. When I was there as Faculty Senate Chair when the board approved the use of NV Energy incentive money to go straight to co-requisite, and I still get chills from how good that moment was, because I knew we had some funding that we could do this. In addition, NSHE reached out, and we've been supported with Strong Start to Finish in the ECMC grants. So thank you. And now I get to highlight a little bit just about my institution's approach. So at our institutional level, we developed an institutional task force to grapple with all the ways to implement this across the institution. We brought teams together from advising, admissions and records, faculty, as well as administrative level, communication at large, working strongly with advising on the pathways, and scheduling. So why I want to note TMCC's approach might be slightly different is that scheduling has many constraints for us. A best practice is that one instructor teaches both the support and the 100 level class back to back so that they can do the just-in-time support within the class as needed. We didn't have that option due to various constraints. So we really had to redesign the curriculum to a granular level so that the support class was designed such a way that students from that class with one instructor could then flow into the next class, which may or may not be with the same instructor, and many were not. So it takes a real standardized curriculum and faculty getting together to think about how to do that when they've never done it before. So we standardized our courses. We have a very robust community of practice. This is another known implementation aspect that's very beneficial, where part-time and full-time faculty get together. It's an organic, informal assessment process so that ongoing improvements can be made both short-term and long-term. And we have many faculty attending this on a regular basis. And then, of course, that leads into well-designed assessment. A lot of work up front so that the rollout could be such that given the constraints we were in, we knew we could do this. We have done the same approach. So we implemented and piloted Math 120 plus 20 last year as our support class, and we've done the same design on full implementation with our Math 126 plus 26 pathway. So I get to share our pilot year data, just a snapshot, of course, just a snapshot of where we landed in our first year. So what I want to highlight with this is how many students we saw with support and without support in 120 plus 20. That was our first pilot year. So we tackled that class first, as you saw or as heard, how much design goes into it. It took about a year for us to get to that point. So we had just over 1,000 students in Math 120 that also needed support, and just over 500 that just needed 120. And here's what I want to give as a takeaway, which is not on this slide. I went back to our Fall 17 data, and over 3 years, from Fall 17 to Fall 20, of the students that placed 1 to 2 levels below developmental completed a college-level class was about 587 students over 3 years. In 1 year of the same group, just looking at output values, 762 students who placed 1 to 2 levels below a gateway math class completed Math 120 last year. So we surpassed in 1 year what we had done over 3 years with just this pilot year. So our results are promising, and we hope to continue. And we also surveyed our students. We surveyed them at the beginning of the first ever CoRec Math 120 class about their feelings or their excitement towards math, and I'm sure you can imagine what their response was, about a 5 out of 10. By the end, we did the same survey questions. It rose to just over 8 out of 10, and it was almost 9 out of 10 on students' feelings that the support helped them succeed in the class. So all promising. And so I will close with saying that now, across ENSHE, every institution has open access math pathways with support. Right? We have 120 with support, 124, and 126. This means that without any prerequisites, students can complete a gateway math class with support in one semester. We do need continued recognition of the faculty, as they are the ones who are in the classroom dealing and implementing this. The challenges are real. We still don't have enough credentialed faculty. The demand is very high for these classes, which is outstanding. The variable skill set of the students in the classes is presenting its own challenges that faculty have not had to handle before, and honing in on the just-in-time support still takes some time, as we all know. It takes time to really work through what that looks like. But we are academics, right? So we will assess both formally and informally as a means for improvement, both in design and delivery. We consider students' success at the forefront of any changes. We're valuing everyone's contribution. We will assess effectively to make the meaningful changes to work together to reform developmental math for Nevada. So thank you. And I will pass it over to Laura.
And I want to say thank you, Anne. I remember when we were discussing the policy, how hesitant you were to move into this direction, and you're a full-on champion, and TMCC has made great strides. So thank you for all your efforts and the efforts of the TMCC faculty. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Geddes. That means a lot.
Good morning. I'm Dr. Laura Decker. I am an assistant professor of English at Nevada State College, and I also coordinate the composition program there, and I served on the English Task Force. I would like to thank the Board of Regents for inviting us to present here today on our co-requisite experience, and especially to Chair Geddes and Vice Chair Del Carlo and the rest of the ARSA committee specifically. I also want to extend similar thanks to Crystal and Renee and James for wonderful leadership within ENSHE, and also to Brandon with CCA. I would also like to thank my colleagues across English departments in ENSHE as well, and I hope that my message today really clearly reiterates Brandon's message of grass tops to grassroots, because that's the experience that we collectively felt. We did have some challenges that I'll share today about the implementation, but collectively we feel like we have walked away with a lot of knowledge and training and especially confidence moving forward, and a community of co-requisite English. And I just remembered I'm supposed to be moving the slides. And I'm not sure how to do that. There we go. So the co-requisite initiative offered faculty across English departments within ENSHE the opportunity to learn from and through one another. You can see here, not to be redundant, but our co-requisite English professional development webinars were wide-ranging in topics. And this was really driven by the collaborative desire of our English Task Force members to shape our professional development in particular ways. I want to stress that the development sessions were also collaborative in nature. For instance, I was able to meet Dr. Emily King from Truckee Meadows Community College and work with her on presenting a webinar about teaching co-requisite English in asynchronous online spaces. And we collectively agree that these professional development webinars gave us a better sense of what co-requisite English is, what it entails, and also ideas for how we could localize that co-requisite curriculum at the individual institutional level. Importantly, we now have stronger relationships across ENCHI in our English departments, and this has opened the door for future collaborations and work together. I want to highlight some of the co-requisite English activities that took place specifically at NSC, because this initiative around co-req English gave us this opportunity for some specific revision and reimagination of what we were already doing. If you're not aware, NSC has a bit of a unique position in co-requisite English because we phased out remedial English years ago and have been operating with a co-requisite English course in place. And we had also had a long-term pilot of English self-placement methods, along with other placement methods. So our lift was a little bit lighter than some of our other institutions, but it was a necessary lift nonetheless. And to borrow a colloquialism from my father, the car seemed to be running fine, but we weren't looking under the hood often enough. So this initiative gave us that opportunity to get a really good look at the engine, so to speak. We hosted many NSC-sponsored events, including some of our own pedagogy workshops centered on our mission as an HSI, as well as assessment for co-requisite English and creating a fully online co-requisite English pathway for our students. And again, we had some really wonderful and necessary conversations about what co-requisite English is and what it looked like at NSC and what our students needed. And I want to stress that this would not have been possible without our ENCHI leadership and those professional development webinars and the task force as well. I also want to highlight that this would have been very challenging without funding, and we were very thankful for the opportunity to apply for grant funds from Strong Start to Finish and ECMC. Because it meant that we were able to pay our faculty for the additional labor, especially within a small English department where lots of people have to, or a few people have to do more. And it was really crucial for paying our faculty for that labor, and I'll speak a little more to that later. The co-requisite initiative also meant that at the ENCHI level, but also at NSC specifically, we really got to think about who our students are in our co-requisite classes and create some development opportunities around that. And we were able to mine our own ENCHI faculty for many of these webinars. For instance, we were able to bring in Dr. Elizabeth Miller from UNR, Dr. Rachel Herzl-Betz from NSC, to lead a webinar on access for students with disabilities in co-requisite English courses. And we were also able to bring in, from CSN, Dr. Nayeli Villanueva and Robin Rohde to talk about equity and contract grading in the co-requisite English course, as well as embedding student services. And it was really wonderful to be able to learn from our own faculty who have expertise in these areas. Specifically at NSC, we offered these virtual pedagogy workshops on supporting our co-requisite students at an HSI and really serving that mission. And these webinars focused on working with culturally and linguistically diverse students in the co-requisite classroom, as well as helping them see their lives as rich sources of inquiry and scholarship. I can tell you off the cuff that our English faculty are really proud that we're now serving our mission as an HSI in our practices in our classrooms. I also want to highlight here that across our ENCHI institutions, part-time faculty are teaching many of our co-requisite courses. And so, again, I want to thank everyone involved in these grant funds that we could apply for, because it meant that we could pay our part-time faculty to do that work as well, and especially because they're teaching so many of these courses. At NSC specifically, we actually had one of our part-time faculty help lead an initiative over the summer, and it's been really wonderful to see our part-time faculty take on some of that leadership and be some of the biggest proponents of co-requisite English. Late in the summer, I asked my NSC colleagues to respond to an anonymous poll about their experiences with the co-requisite initiative at the ENCHI level as well as at NSC specifically. And 100% reported being more clear about what co-requisite pedagogy was, more confident and more knowledgeable about their practices in the co-requisite classroom, and more excited to teach co-requisite English. There'd always been a little bit of confusion around English 100 before this, so that was really wonderful to see. As the responses that I have on this slide can demonstrate, my faculty also felt that they had really been empowered to shape co-requisite, that it was really their process to own. And they really loved that they had come together as a community, that they had been able to learn from one another and also teach one another and work on this project together. That is also something that has been echoed across the NSHE departments as well with the task force. So I just want to end with a few experiences from my sister institutions because we check in now with one another about co-requisite English, which is really wonderful. At TMCC, the faculty have developed a Canvas page with material for supporting co-requisite instruction, asynchronous discussions about teaching and supporting our co-requisite students, as well as dedicated meetings, virtual for the time being, around co-requisite English. They're also working collaboratively to put together an open educational resource reader for their co-requisite English courses. I want to briefly talk about one of the challenges that we've had with co-requisite implementation, and that's been around scheduling. At NSC, we use a 5-credit English 100 co-requisite model. And because our full-time faculty teach 12-credit semester loads, and our part-time faculty are limited to 9 credits, you can do the math there. It's been a little bit challenging to schedule a 5-credit course for our faculty without going under or over. And at UNLV, they're using a 3+1+1 model, which is 3 credits of college writing, a 1-credit reading lab, and a 1-credit writing lab. Their issue has been finding enough faculty to teach all the lab sections. And so they've mitigated this for the time being by spreading out co-requisite English from just the fall to the fall and spring semesters, but it's still an issue that they're working on with advising and the registrar. At CSN and TMCC, where their faculty teach 15-credit semesters, they report that the implementation with scheduling has been really smooth and that there's a lot of faculty buy-in. And then finally, CSN shared with me some of the ways that they use their grant funding. One of those ways was to train faculty to work with embedded writing tutors in their co-requisite English classrooms, which we know is one really wonderful data-driven way to support our students. And they also led a community of practice event around using open educational resources in the co-requisite classroom. And this was co-led by PTI as well as full-time faculty. The faculty involved in that community practice wanted to pass on the message that they found those conversations, quote, quite refreshing. So I just want to end again with a thank you for the opportunity to share our experience and just reiterate that the grass tops to grassroots approach was really effective. Faculty feel like they owned this. They did own this. They continue to own this. And we really feel like NSHE English departments have come together as this wonderful co-requisite English community where we've developed expertise and practices, and we feel really confident about going forward with the challenges. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Laura. Thank you, Anne. Thank you, Brandon. I do want to say this is an issue that we've struggled with for decades in trying to address remedial education, and it looks like we've made very good progress, and this is something that the board pushed forward and was able to start the funding with some grant money that we got, and then the system and staff were able to find more grant money to cover all these costs. And I think this is truly going to change remedial education in Nevada going forward and change all of our success rates. So I thank you all for that. And do I have any questions or comments?
Chair Geddes, this is Regent Carvalho. I had a few comments.
Ahead, Regent Carvalho.
Thank you. I wanted to reiterate what's been said several times, that there was a lot of apprehension when this process first started, and I'm so proud of where the members of this task force have ended up. Your work is tremendous, and I really thank you for putting in the time and effort into this. And I really like the tagline that has been mentioned, that every college student is college ready, but I think that there might be a parallel tagline to that as well, that every college is student ready. And I think that the work of this task force did that as well. It isn't just what we need to get our students who need to be up to speed with, getting them the support they need, but also making sure that our institutions are ready for all students who come in. And I think that that's really a foundation of this work. So thank you so much.
Mr. Chair?
Thank you. And I do want to add in the comment that the way the faculty embraced it and put together their work groups and built this together, it would not work without the faculty developing all of this. So I truly appreciate all of the faculty and their willingness to embrace this and put the program together. I'm sorry, who was that?
That's Regent Carter.
Regent Carter, go ahead.
I just kind of want to reiterate that I love the grassroots comparison there. You know, we as a board kind of pushed against some headwinds to make a data-based decision and did that. And at that point, a task force was put together, and that task force spawned off tons of other little task forces at the institutions. The institutions bought off on that. So whether they were, commiserating against our decision or whatever they wanted to do, but it got you all on board, and I'm really happy where we are now, and I think that's a great model for change where the board can really push some good database decisions, and then task forces with very specific purposes can then try to drive that back to the institutions, get the buy-in, build up all the input, and come back with the actual implementation. And I think this is just a project to be very proud of. Thank you.
Thank you, Regent Carter. Any other comments?
This is Regent Del Carlo. I have a couple questions and some comments, too.
Go ahead, Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you, Chair Geddes. I'm not sure who to address this to, but I know on slide 10 you said the attendance was recorded when you did those nine classes, or 10 for math, or maybe it was English 10. But they were recorded. They were well attended. I'm hearing they weren't mandatory. So I'm wondering if any faculty out there didn't attend. Did they attend some of them, not all of them? Do they get up to speed? I mean, the key really is the faculty. So is everybody pretty much on board now?
For the record, Crystal Abba, all of those professional development webinars were recorded. So for those faculty that weren't able to attend during the actual event itself, they are available online. And I think the key to this is the communities of practice that have been created as a result of the professional development session. So it really has changed the culture in terms of the networking that's happening between faculty as they experience the change and then share what's working and share what's not working and make change, because that's really the key to this. This is about continuous improvement.
Thank you, Vice Chancellor Abba, and I agree. This is a cultural change. I was really proud to be part of this in 2019 when we had Complete College America come, and the data was just so overwhelming. And one of the other points in this is that we have a shared governance model here in Nevada, and I was wondering with Brandon, he said it's not going as well in some other states. Does the fact that we have a shared governance model, did that help in this situation compared to other states? If Brandon's still in the room?
I'm still here. I think one of the things that made this successful was really how the leadership provided the support, but then empower the faculty to lead it. And so I think you saw this even with some of the speakers we had here, but who are representative of other faculty. This is a very big change, and that apprehension is real. And sometimes, and we saw this here in Nevada as well, there's some initial pushback. And so to have folks who were part of that saying, hey, we're not sure about this, to now come, as you heard me say, become champions, I think that we saw that today, and that was through the process of that empowerment of the faculty to lead it.
Thank you. And I want to thank all the faculty that were part of this. I mean, this was a real cultural change for us, and I applaud you for helping the students. And I think there's really strength in having one system. I loved when you went back and you did the Common Course numbering, you went and did curricular reviews, because being one system, I think there's just so many strengths there. And I would just say, Chair Geddes, a year from now, you're still going to be on the board, probably still head at ARSA, but I'd love to have you bring some students back. And let's hear from the students after this phenomenal change for them, because I love that slide where it said they did it so much faster because they were taking those classes that didn't lead to success. So, I mean, I'm really proud of this effort. So thank you to everybody, especially faculty.
Thank you. That's a good suggestion.
And Vice Chancellor Alba for leading the charge.
Yes, I'll make sure Vice Chancellor Alba puts it on new business. If I'm chair or not chair or whoever's chair, I'll make sure she puts it on the list.
Chair Geddes?
See no other comments, Vice Chancellor
Chair Geddes?
Oh, sorry, go ahead, Chair.
This is Regent McAdoo. I wanted to, I can't help but say this, that I thought the COREC presentation demonstrated the need and the value of funding for mandated policies and requirements. I know we talk about that a lot. And it also showed the collaborative success of our institutions and faculty. And honestly, it took, I said a system, and then I changed it to it took the system. It took Nevada's system, all of us, to make this happen. And I couldn't be prouder of the moment. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair McAdoo. Vice Chancellor Ava?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to end this agenda item by indicating that this is the first of many reports to come, obviously, because this is a continual improvement process. We have an assessment plan in place. You will receive future reports where at the system level we are looking at specific metrics to measure student progress, and that's an excellent opportunity to then bring students in and have them report on their experiences in the COREC model. So, again, thank you all.
Thank you. We will now go to item number 11, Nishi Foster Youth Waiver Program. Vice Chancellor Abba.
Thank you. For the record, Crystal Abba, Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs. This final report of the morning is in regards to the Nishi Foster Youth Program. This is a fee waiver program, and I want to stress to the board that this is unique in that this particular waiver was not mandated by the state legislature. This is your waiver. This is a waiver that was created by this board, but what separates it from many of the existing waiver programs is the partnership that we have with philanthropy. On Tuesday, I had the honor of meeting with Yali Lincroft, who is the vice president for the philanthropy division of the Whittier Trust, and their work in partnership with the Walter S. Johnson Foundation, which funds Laura's position. So Laura is a new protege in our academic and student affairs department, but her position is fully funded through the philanthropy of the Walter S. Johnson Foundation Group. And why that's critical is that with this fee waiver program, it's one thing to say we're going to waive fees. It's another thing to create the infrastructure within the system to support those students. And that's really what Laura does. The Walter S. Johnson Foundation has also awarded funds to TMCC and to UNLV that are also supporting this work. But we received two grants. The first year grant was $200,000 for Laura's position and the supporting work, and then we received another two-year grant at $400,000. So it really is an exemplary example of a partnership with an external entity that has a philosophy of supporting these types of students in need, and it truly separates this waiver program from existing waiver programs. So with that, I am proud to turn this over to my newest academic and student affairs staff member, Laura Obrist.
Thank you, Vice Chancellor Abba. For the record, Laura Obrist, Nishi Foster Youth Ambassador.
I want to thank the Regents for inviting me to present to you today on our fee waiver program. It really has been an honor and a privilege the last 26 months to be in this position. It says it on the website, this really is a dream job for me to collaborate with the statewide community at our institutions and in the community. I really couldn't list all the people that it's an honor to collaborate with every day. And so I'm very honored to be here today. Hopefully I can work the clicker. So already failing. Which button is it? Okay, there we go. Okay, so I'm going to be covering two things today. First is just the progress of the fee waiver program, and then some major highlights of the statewide foster youth success initiative. And so first I just want to give you an update on the growth of the fee waiver program. So the NCHA Foster Youth Success Initiative was launched when the board unanimously approved the foster youth fee waiver, which was in September 2018. So we are now exactly at the three-year mark of the this really crucial piece of financial aid for our students who have experienced foster care. So Nevada was the 29th state to implement a program like this specifically for this student population, and now in 2021, there are 35 states that have a program like this for this student population. And so in approving the fee waiver, the board really laid the foundation for our system to be able to provide more robust support for this student population. And in following the board's lead, we really have a great statewide community that is made up of our NCHA institutions, NCHA system administration, and a great community statewide of community partners that are looking to build a more comprehensive, permanent, and sustainable support system for these students. And that's really from the point of secondary education completion to post-secondary education attainment to a career path. And that is kind of the overarching goal of our initiative. So this is a smaller student population, but they have very prominent needs, and that it comes from a variety of things. So, you know, kind of first and foremost, it, you know, is trauma. So by definition, this is a population of students that has experienced abuse and or neglect. That is why they have been in foster care. So things around basic needs, deficiencies, foster care placement changes that lead to school changes that impact their education path all the way through, school transportation issues that they deal with in the K-12 system, bias disciplinary practices, suspension and expulsion, and then just really a severe lack of support that comes from removal from their families. And then in the foster care system itself, anyone that works in that system will tell you they just don't have the resources to be able to provide support. And really with education, there's just so many other needs to meet that to be able to provide support with the education path is just so limited. And we see with Nevada high school graduation rates that students who have experienced foster care have, in the last 3 years, tracked by the Nevada Department of Education, between 32 and 37% lower, 32 and 37 percentage points lower graduation rates than the general student population, and so that's really significant. And as young adult students who have been in foster care are really at great risk of experiencing homelessness. And in Nevada, those rates are really almost at the bottom in comparison to the rest of the country. And we know that post-secondary education is really a key factor in addressing that issue in terms of getting living wage jobs, you know, financial security, and housing stability. We know that only about 3 to 11% of students who have experienced foster care attain a bachelor's degree, but we know that about 70 to 84% of 17 and 18-year-olds in foster care want to go to college. And so we really want to support them with that desire. Students who have experienced foster care who successfully enroll in college are more likely than their peers to delay that, to enroll part-time because of the pressure to work to support themselves, because they don't have as much support. They don't have a support system to fall back on. They're also more likely to need developmental courses and co-requisite support than other students because of those challenges that they experience. It makes it harder for them to persist in college. So very relevant to the presentation that we just heard. So in line with our strategic plan goals of access, success, closing the achievement gap. It's, you know, important to know that aside from these unique needs sort of that I described, that they face, that this population also overlaps with other populations that we are seeking to serve in our strategic plan. So the vast majority of these students are considered low income. They're eligible for things like the federal Pell Grant, the federal Supplemental Educational Opportunity Grant, or the SEOG, federal work study. The vast majority of them are first generation, and even if they're not, they haven't had the opportunity to benefit from their biological parents' college education status. And then there's a disproportionate number of youth of color in the foster care system. And so supporting these students also means supporting our MSI and HSI work. Serving these students with dedicated funding is also particularly important because once enrolled, we know that they struggle to meet all of their academic and personal financial obligations, even with support of federal funding. And so that's why programs like our tuition waiver are so important. State-based tuition assistance programs like our fee waiver provide really crucial support. And there's very limited data on this nationwide, and so we actually, you know, can really be a leader here. Texas actually has had a waiver since 2009, and they're one of the few, actually one of the only areas we know of that has data on this, and it shows that students are 3.5 times more likely to graduate with a bachelor's degree in terms of looking at students that are eligible if they utilize that waiver. Okay, so moving on. So since the Fee Waiver policy was approved, the Coordinated Statewide Network has been working diligently to raise awareness of the program throughout the state. The waiver waives course registration and laboratory fees for students who are dependents of the Nevada system specifically at age 14 or older, and it has grown by more than 135% since its creation 3 years ago. So the total cost of the fee waiver program for the first cohort in 18 to 19 came in at just over $104,000 with 38 waivers. And that was, you know, passing after the semester had already started in fall of 18. In the next year, when more folks knew about it, it more than doubled with 78 waivers at just over $237,000, and then 90 waivers in the 20 to 21 year at just under $333,000. So we know that capturing return on investment and the fee waiver is critical. So our Department of Academic and Student Affairs, which now oversees the initiative, has created a plan to improve future system-wide data collection on students who are utilizing the waiver. So building upon the current annual total dollars awarded, total number of students awarded, we're going to begin tracking completion measures, including persistence and graduation rates, disaggregated by race and ethnicity. And again, just given the current lack of data nationwide on this, we really can be a leader here in tracking this return on investment data. So this expanded effort will really enable me and the institution level staff and faculty that are directly serving these students to continue improving services for them. It'll also allow us to potentially pursue future internal and external funding opportunities to really support our initiative work and reach the level of wraparound support that we need to help these students thrive in college. So next, I'm just going to talk a little bit about the collaborative statewide initiative work. So as a result of the fee waiver approval and establishment of the initiative, we applied for and received $600,000 in private grant funding, as Vice Chancellor Abba already mentioned, from the Walter S. Johnson Foundation to create my role. And as she already mentioned as well, TMCC and UNLV were able to get grants as well to strengthen support for their students. So the primary mission of the initiative is really just to effectively recruit, support, and retain these students. And the fee waiver is so central to that. In collaboration with the statewide network that I mentioned, you know, obviously my job is really to achieve that mission. And so I see my role as really having three kind of primary buckets. And so the first one is financial aid. So we obviously, the whole point of this presentation is the fee waiver is very central to what we do. And so the fee waiver is key in that. And then also looking at state and federal grants, federal work study, scholarships, education vouchers. So there's a federal ETV resource that in Nevada is administered by the Children's Cabinet. Not everyone's eligible, but making sure we're looking for that and looking for students that come from other states. In foster care, students are moved between states sometimes, you know, very unexpectedly through, you know, no choice of their own. And so making sure that we're looking for what they're eligible for. The second thing is really wraparound support. And so obviously first focusing on our institutions, helping them build support on the campuses, designing things that will really help support our students, helping our community partners understand college stuff for our students, what they need to know about processes, and really supporting them with what they need to help our students be successful. And then the third thing is really kind of leading and supporting state and federal policy advocacy efforts that serve the educational best interests of the student population. So in terms of some of the highlights of things that we've been working on, so really building on the fee waiver resource, we have some kind of notable things that we have been able to accomplish in the last 2 years. And so the first, you know, kind of bucket area is really focused on really building a statewide learning community that collaborates and is really committed to learning about this population so that we can better serve them, so that we know what we're doing. So we have had two annual retreats that have been filled with facilitated discussions, targeted goals, and follow-up tasks. We've developed a strategic plan that we've reviewed prior to and during the second retreat and revised based on the feedback provided. In October 19, we had an NG delegation that went to a conference in LA that's nationally renowned, conference that focuses specifically on post-secondary education support for this population. And we're hoping to go again in early 2022. We launched a, you know, statewide network and established a committee that meets quarterly with partners across the state, including all of our institutions and a bunch of different agencies, all the child welfare agencies and a bunch of other partners, including, you know, the attorneys that support students and a bunch of other partners. After UNLV secured their grant, I convened an expert panel on best practices for campus-based support, shared the recording with our institutions and community partners. We were able to utilize some grant funding to have 20 statewide NCHE representatives and community partners participate in a training that's nationally renowned that is focused on higher ed support for this population. And then the second kind of focus area is really student voice and leadership. And that is really important for this population because these students have really spent their lives in situations and systems that have given them very little autonomy. And very often decisions were made that were not in their best interest. And so we know that student support programming only works if it is student-led and or informed. And so this is a very important component of the work. And so everything we do, you know, that is really woven into our work, and student input and participation is always welcome and encouraged. We have students serving on the statewide committee. We have students participate in the annual retreats. We've led with their input when we've developed and revised the strategic plan. In fall 19, the former chancellor held roundtable discussions with some of our students that resulted in a memo with concrete recommendations that went to all the institution presidents. In the 20 to 21 year, we utilized some grant funding to establish the system level peer and community educator role. So that's a part-time student position that works closely with me in the chancellor's office, providing outreach and training to students and she employees, community partners across the state. So the role is designed to give a new student opportunity every year. So we had a UNR student last year that just transitioned out. We have a UNLV student that just started for this year. And then one of the major projects that student did last year was a statewide or a system-wide needs survey that we'll release the results of soon. And so that was really useful in getting a lot of quantitative and qualitative data on what our students are experiencing at all of our institutions. The third kind of area is
around system-level outreach and resource development and provision. So knowing that our students and their support people or institutions or partners need reliable information about processes, resources with post-secondary education. Specific to this student population, we've really worked to create electronic reference materials, online and social media presence that will better serve their needs. So I received, especially at the beginning of the pandemic, a greater influx of crisis calls. One of the most frequent inquiries has really been around concerns around covering costs of full cost of attendance. And so I developed the Nevada Fostering Higher Education Financial Aid Toolkit. It's on our website, which our statewide community regularly shares, and I'll continue to update that. This student population also has special considerations when it comes to completing the FAFSA. So I developed a foster care specific quick reference financial aid overview and a step-by-step sort of FAFSA instructions guide. I regularly share that information. I'm working on adapting some webinars for our website. And with the onset of the pandemic, we were also able to get one-time approval to provide some relief support directly to students through our grant funding and through a Nevada-specific rapid response program through a national partnership with an organization called Together We Rise. We also did some promotional videos that are in final editing stages. And then our last big area is really building capacity at our institutions, which is obviously super important. And so we need to accurately identify these students to serve them. And so one of the first things we did was implementing a foster care history identification question on all the admissions apps. So our last institution was able to do that for the fall 2021 admissions cycle. A lot of institutions did it much earlier. In terms of persistence and graduation rates, we know that in addition to financial aid, we need the wraparound support and various types of stability and mentorship support, and also dedicated employees that can invest time and energy. And so one of our areas of success here has been TMCC's Walter S. Johnson Foundation grant implementation. And so that has been focused on housing stability and peer mentorship support. And then in terms of dedicated campus-based staff, we know that in states that have campus-based support programs, for instance, California, that students are 3 times more likely to remain in college in this population compared to their peers nationwide that don't have those programs. And so we want to join that trend. And so we're happy to say that UNLV is now the first higher education institution in Nevada with a full-time position that is 100% dedicated to serving their enrolled students with foster care experience. So we have Heather Richardson at UNLV who's hit the ground running and is doing that work and is about to launch their Fostering Scholars program. That will be campus-based support programs serving students that are qualifying that have been in foster care using some of their grant funding. And then also UNR has made their own internal investment in a 21 to 22 GA position. And building on that, they were invited to submit a letter of inquiry to Walter S. Johnson Foundation. And then actually as an update, even since I submitted my materials to the board, to the board staff in early August, they were invited to submit a full grant proposal for $200,000 to the foundation to establish campus-based supports similar to what UNLV is looking to do with their Fostering Scholars program. So I know that was a lot of information. That's all the updates that I have for you. And do you have any questions for me?
Thank you, Laura and Crystal. Are there any questions?
Chair Gates, I have a question. This is Regent Del Carlo.
Go ahead, Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you. Laura, I'm so glad you've been in this position since the start. I think it's really great continuity. I was just wondering on slide 4, the total number of students. We've gone from 38 to 78 to 90. How do you identify the students for this program? Do you work with social workers? Do these foster students hear about it from other foster students? I just want to know what the pipeline is to make sure we're reaching a wide enough net. Thank you.
Yes. So this population is often hidden, and so it is a constant process of trying to get better at identifying the students. So definitely adding the admissions app question was really crucial, and we will keep seeing more with that.
The FAFSA is definitely an important way, but that's also not perfect because sometimes students will either intentionally not identify because they don't want to be associated with foster care and don't realize that that will actually negatively impact them, or they will accidentally not identify, or they will mark the wrong category. FAFSA's gotten a little bit smarter over the years in the way that they have sort of done their logic around that, and so some of that has gotten a little bit better. But we try to use all methods. So yes, we do collaborate. That's why we have the whole community engaged, and we have the quarterly meetings, and we stay in constant contact with all the community partners. So we make sure that the independent living programs, that the Step Up program in Clark County, and independent living in all areas, the rural counties, everywhere, is talking to their young people about this, that our contacts at the colleges are doing their outreach as well, recruitment. So yeah, it really takes a village, as they say, and everyone really working together. So yeah, it's never a perfect system, but that's one of the things I'm always watching for, is where the gaps are. So that is always something we're working on. One of the things we did with financial aid is also because we don't have a process to automatically, unless they apply for the fee waiver, financial aid doesn't mandate them to verify if they mark that on their FAFSA. So we've also had a process with financial aid where they've been reaching out to try to send letters and things like that if they've identified that. GBC has been trying to work on outreach because, as you probably saw, they've been struggling a little bit with getting some students. They have had some almost folks that have been in some sort of adjacent categories, and it just hasn't worked out in the last couple years. So we do hope to see some movement there, but that's kind of where we're at right now. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments?
Chair Geddes,
hearing
this is
none?
This is Regent Carvalho again. I should just be an honorary
Go
member
ahead,
of this committee. I want to thank you, Laura, for all the work that you've done on behalf of our foster youth in Nevada. I think, like you said, it really does take a village, and you being leader in this area is really tremendous, and I really want to thank you. I also want to thank the Walter S. Johnson Foundation for all of the funds that they've put behind this. I know that that they've given money even outside of NCHI to help our foster youth. I'm fortunate to have St. Jude's Ranch in my district, and I've heard from them recently that total cost of attendance is a big concern for students, and as we heard earlier with the financial aid presentation, it's important for all students and for us to understand that the total cost of attendance is much larger than just tuition, and for our foster youth students, that can be an even greater obstacle. So thank you for the work that you've done on that, and thank you so much to the Walter S. Johnson Foundation for their commitment to this population.
Thank you. Thank you again, Laura, and thank you, Crystal. Seeing no other questions or comments, we will close item number 11, move on to item number 12, new business. Is there any new business? Hearing none, we will go to public comment. Is there any public comment in Elko?
There is no public comment in Elko at this time.
There is no public comment in Reno. Is there any public comment in Las Vegas?
There is no public comment in Las Vegas.
We are adjourned.